Hello, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you doing?
Well, you know, somewhat fabulous is kind of my standard response.
Well, again, I want to thank you for being on last week, and obviously you enjoyed it enough you wanted to call in this week, so what's going on? What's shaking?
Well, I accidentally forgot to delete the rearranged schedule broadcast that we had here, so I had a double up on my calendar, so here I am.
Welcome back.
I'm here by accident.
Well, it's not an accident at all. When you want to be here, you're more than welcome. I mean, as long as I can stay on my subject. I'm talking about some other people that you might or might not know, like Nuttin' Fancy. He's a big name on YouTube. And I saw one of his videos, and it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. It's great that he has a philosophy, but he's selling people a philosophy that he has in his heart. And I feel like a lot of people are going to fall victim to bugging in or staying at their homes when things are horribly, terribly bad, and they really should have a plan to be elsewhere. I've lived through that, as a matter of fact. I lived through Hurricane Andrew in Miami. I got hit by it. The whole city was affected, and I would not want to be living in a place like that. If anything like that happened again, I would want to be as far away as possible until they got things back to normal.
Yeah, I interviewed G. Edward Griffin this one time, and he said that what we really should be concerned about and is a real easy fix to prevent from happening is a global blackout from a solar burst or something like that. And he says that all the transformers that we have holding the grid together, they're all unique. Like, you can't just mass produce them. Like, everything gets wiped out, and then you just go, oh, okay, well, let's just build a whole bunch of new transformers. No, each and every one of them is individual and unique. And to shield each and every single one of them from an electromagnetic burst like that would be reasonably expensive. However, the consequence of not doing it potentially is that within the first 30 days of the power grid being off, you're looking at a massive percentage of the population dying in the first 30 days alone. And after that,
I have to agree with that. I mean, we ran the numbers. I have some friends who are strategists. They actually specialize in strategy and number crunching of that nature. And when we ran the numbers, we found that 90 days. Now, you're talking 30. I'm telling you 90. We stretched it out. Within 90 days, the population of the average American city, large American city, will be decimated by anywhere from 80 to 95% of the population dead.
Well, that was what Mr. Griffin said. I just couldn't remember whether it was a month or 3 months. So, yeah, 3 months. 3 months. And then basically almost everybody's dead.
Yeah, and in that case, it's really, and in my opinion, it's completely avoidable, just like his. Not just that we can reinforce the electrical grid, but we can prepare ourselves so that if it does happen, the lack of electricity, which, let's face it, electricity is less than 300 years old. The lack of electricity should, by any means, not be that. But because we are so technologically dependent, it is that harmful. It will be that much of a threat if we lose it.
It's become almost the essential to life. I mean, we had a power cut here in Auckland, New Zealand last year, and it lasted for like 14 hours. And, you know, if it had lasted for a day longer, it would have actually really started to cause problems, because you're sitting there and you're like, oh, okay, man, the first thing that strikes you is boredom, because you think that the power is going to come back on. And I was just thinking about this in a survival situation. Okay, if the power's not coming back on, you need to start moving quickly. You know,
right.
Like you don't really have time to spare. People are going to be rushing and buying out stuff and clogging up the roads. It's going to be panic, more or less. And you've got to basically be ahead of the pack. A friend of mine, he's comes from a very wealthy family, and his father had bought them all dirt bikes. So in the event that something goes wrong or whatever and the roads are blocked, not only can they go off-road, but they can also weave in between the cars. And they've got little carriers on the back of the bikes with tents, shelter, small supplies of food and certain bug-out points and what have you that they can go to. So it just... what was it? History favors the prepared?
It absolutely does. I mean, let's face it. in an emergency situation, if you're ready, it's as I try. Preparedness is like insurance. You either choose to have insurance against the bad things that happen in life. It's an investment. It's time and it's money. But in the end, it should pay for itself. You don't plan on getting in a car accident. You don't plan on falling over dead tomorrow. But you have car insurance just in case, and you have life insurance just in case. Why not be prepared? Why not have living insurance, prepper insurance, if you will? If things go horribly wrong, you can still make sure that you're going to be eating, that you're going to live in a moderate means of comfort, at least for a while, until you can get your feet under you. I encourage people to look at all the bad things that have happened in history. We're not exclusive in this age for wanting to make sure that we're prepared for the bad things. I mean, let's look back in history and just see it.
Yeah, I mean, those who don't learn the lesson of history are doomed to repeat it, as the old saying goes. My question is, we're now in a time where the tech that we have access to, and I'm not just talking about electrical technology, I'm just talking about like general tools, like the multi-tool, for example, the one that's got pliers and a knife and a saw and all of that kind of jazz on it. They're so freaking useful. And being a prepper today is probably the easiest point in history to be one, isn't it? All the rest of the times through history, they didn't have multi-tools. They didn't have gas barbecues, cookers, and things of that nature. I mean, it's almost like survival today is so much easier. The problem is we're also so much more dependent on these technological conveniences to keep us alive, that if the rug gets pulled out from under us, you're talking about the end of civilization as you know it in a very short time frame.
That's very true, because it's like I try to point out to people, you can rely on technology to a certain point, but if you put too much reliance in technology, you're actually just putting another crutch under your other arm. Right now, you're relying on technology to live day to day. If you're going to rely on technology after the collapse, I'm talking more specifically the more modern technologies, then when those things break or you lose them or they stop working for whatever reason, you're back to the 1800s, where you were lucky if you had steam technology.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I heard somebody say that this is probably one of the best ideas, is actually to learn up a bit on steam technology and how to actually build steam engines yourself, just in case. And I was like, oh, that's a bit extreme, but it will be Little House in the Prairie out there.
Well, that's very true. And, you know, that technological thing always brings this to mind. I mean, it technological.
Regional governors now have direct control over their territories. Fear will keep the local systems in line.
Hello? Hey, what's going on?
I love doing that. I love popping up stuff like that. I mean, it's just really, you bear in mind that we're reliant on technology, and a lot of people look to their cell phones to navigate. They look to their cell phones to get the web and pull up instant information. What happens when those things get cut off, Vinny? That's the question people have to ask, and that's what I try to encourage them to do. I try to encourage them to look at 1800s life. Take a really hard look at what the people that went on the westward expansion lived like. I mean, they lived out of a wagon, and probably the most technologically advanced thing that they had was a gun.
It's probably the last resort as well, and it seems to be that people are, I don't know, that they're acting under the illusion that even if everything's screwed, that everybody will come together, sort of thing. Now, there is an element of that I see, particularly in natural disasters. I mean, at the very least, the Christchurch earthquake that we had here in New Zealand, communities that had no real community fabric, like they didn't know their neighbours or anything like that, came together within hours of the first earthquakes hitting and started getting water for each other and started feeding each other, and this community kind of managed to keep on going on. But that was because they were capable of having the power restored, and plumbing and things like that. There were a number of people living in red zone homes that had massive cracks in the walls and things like that, and the plumbing broke, and they just couldn't live in those homes because you cannot live in a house that doesn't have any plumbing, generally speaking, or any power. It's almost like a waste of time. At best, it's just shelter.
Well, I mean, and again, I wanted to point that out in my earlier segment, the beginning segment, when I was talking about Nut and Fancy. He keeps in his mind that his home is his safe place. It's like his womb. I mean, the way he talks, you would think that the man is not going to walk out the front door unless his house is burnt to the ground. And I keep trying to encourage people to understand that in a long-term collapse scenario, I mean, here's where you know you're in really deep doo-doo. When the power goes out and the phone systems aren't working, there's a big problem. I went through multiple hurricanes, and the phone lines carry their own power. In hell, with the new cellular technology, you've got connection most anywhere. But when the power goes out and the communication systems go out, then you're in real trouble because you have no way of calling on help. You have no way of accessing outside aid, and you're basically on your own. And, you know, I would say that's a major red flag if you're staying at your house. I would consider packing your stuff and going somewhere else.
See, me, I'm kind of like a bit of an idealist still. I get the idea that I could, like, go outside with a megaphone as soon as everything's screwed and actually pull people together and act like a leader and get people to work in groups and teams and things, extracting resources, starting to grow food. My wife's an organic gardener, a specialist in permaculture and all of these kind of things. And it reminds me of what happened in Cuba when they first had the trade embargoes, is that basically everybody was forced to grow food everywhere. Every square inch of soil, potatoes underneath the corn, they managed to prevent themselves from starving to death. Now, I'm not saying communism's good, but in a crisis, if you can motivate people and you can get them to take action to actually save their lives, you can often survive along with them. And that's the second approach that I think might be I'm not 100% sure whether or not that's even viable, though, in a, okay, everything's suddenly out of kilter situation. Maybe people will be too panicked to organize. And maybe it's just pie in the sky, thinking that they won't just shoot you and take your megaphone.
Well, and again, I try to point out that, you know, everywhere is different. Every country, every society out there is pretty much different. I mean, it doesn't matter how alike the society is from America to England to France, etc. Western society as a whole, very similar. But when you get down to the brass tacks, when you get down to the realities of people interacting with other people within that society, there are huge differences between the way people are in a place like New Zealand and a place like Houston or the United States, any city. The population of the city that I live near is as large as the population of your entire country. And in my neighborhood, the old neighborhood I lived in, a vast majority of the people that lived there were not homeowners. They were renters. They were middle to low income. They lived paycheck to paycheck. They barely had any of the social niceties going on. I mean, we're talking about people that would crank up the music at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday and party until six and had no regard for other people around them, multiple police phone calls, etc. I mean, this is a society, at least in the United States, that is so broken, that is so dysfunctional on a most basic human level, that should anything major like this happen, I fully anticipate that if you live in a suburb like that, you'll be shooting your way out within 3 days.
I just wonder as well if the more it seems to be that the New World Order has dumbed everybody down, right? And so that whenever there's a crisis, they will panic and obey any kind of authority figure. And I'm just wondering if you could just pseudo do that, you know, and just like, okay, everybody, I am the authority. I now control this community. I have the guns. I have the know-how. You are going to listen to me and you are going to live. How many people would blindly follow you and actually survive as a result?
Well, therein lies the rub. I mean, how many people are that gullible or that able to follow? I mean, it might look good on the surface. It might start off well, but you're not talking about 2 days. You're talking about 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, 2 decades. There's a lot of time for personal resentments to be built in. I mean, at first they're reaching out. It's like the drowning man grabbing for the life preserver. They're going to grab on anything that they can see that might save them. But after time, complacency and comfort kicks in, and then that mentality turns to, well, why am I not leading? Why am I not doing X, Y, and Z? A lot of resentment can be built. You just look at Afghanistan, you look at Iraq, you look at the neighborhoods there. Most of those people were not directly involved in the war. And when the United States brought in the interim government troops, they were shot at and blown up just as frequently as the people who were against the United States. The people just didn't want anything to do with the quote-unquote authority figure. They had it up to here because their homes had been blown up and a lot of bad shit had gone on in their neighborhoods. So in some cases, I could see that working. But in others, I'm thinking immediate and long term. I try to take a gestalt approach to it. I try to take a large mindset. Sure, I can see the advantages short term, but you also have to look long term. You have to look beyond the first 2 weeks.
I think that survival is something you shouldn't think about short term. Well, in an ideal world.
Well, let me tell you something. The basic prepper, the starting prepper, let me just throw that out there. The beginning prepper is told, get 3 weeks worth of food, 3 weeks worth of water, and enough stuff to survive for 3 weeks. And that's a good place to start, but don't stop there. I absolutely positively encourage everybody to start at least with, if you can't afford 3 weeks, start with 3 days, but don't stop there. And there are tons of good tools out there to help you organize, build, track, and basically keep a good handle on your preps. And I have 6 apps that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. There's 6 free applications for your iPhone or your pad that you can use as a prepper to get yourself organized. I mean, they're not great. I'm not advocating be reliant on this tool, but hell, if it gets you organized, if it gets you connected, if it gets you where you need to be, use it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just do something. Don't do nothing. Really?
Well, That is true.
Yeah. I mean, time's a waste, and there's several minutes in every hour. There's several hours in every day. What are you doing? You know?
Right.
For every moment that you delay, there's an increased possibility that your family might die as a result of your neglect. And I think this is part of the other interesting element about the prepper movement is that there's, I mean, I'm sure you've seen these people, Falcon, those who have actually kind of taken prepping to the extreme and have actually lost their grip on reality just a little bit.
Well, I think we are all in danger of that no matter what. I mean, you take anything to an extreme. You take sports fanaticism to an extreme. You take alternative media to an extreme. I can name some names in that category. You take anything to an extreme and you start losing a firm grip on reality. What you have to do is have a balanced approach to life in anything. I'm not 100% about prepping. I don't do nothing but prep. I mean, I do my radio show, which, yes, it's about prepping, but it's something completely different. The format is different. It's just me talking. I do a blog, which is about politics and prepping combined. I play games. I actually play games. I mean, I take some time in the evening time before I go to bed to actually do mindless things, to unwind, to disconnect for a while. I watch movies. My life is not about prepping, but prepping has a very prominent place in my life. I can't say otherwise. I mean, and if you want to call me crazy, but I lived through too many disasters. I've lived through too many collapses of local society to not be aware of where we're headed globally, let alone locally, to not want to have food, water, and other essentials put back just in case.
nobody who went to FEMA's Superdome and after Hurricane Katrina thought the government had a handle on things. They even have food and water delivered to that puppy for half the time.
Well, and again, we prepare so we don't end up at the Superdome. I mean, and I keep pointing out to people, your preps might start off like mine did in defense against, or in how shall I say this, in not wishing to go through what I went through during Hurricane Andrew. I never, ever, ever want to be without a home, without food, without water, without the basics. I mean, I didn't even have toilet paper. I survived Andrew only by the virtue that I left the city and came back after the storm had passed through the very next day. And I had nothing. I literally had a basket of clothes that I could salvage and a couple of boxes of waterlogged things that I threw in my car. Literally had nothing. And I told myself right then and there, I will not live like this ever again. I will not be without. Now, I was pointing out to the listeners earlier that if you have all of your preps stashed away at your house, well, in my case, if it had been like that at Andrew, my house was wiped out. My preps would have been destroyed. So what good would have buying all those things and stashing them away in my house been? I needed to have a secondary place far enough away that it couldn't be affected by that particular storm. You know, if where I was at got affected, where my stuff was wouldn't be. You know what I'm saying?
Mm. I just wonder exactly how far away that it would have to be. I mean, if you're talking about having to be outside of a storm or something, you'd have to have it like several hundred miles away. And if there is a storm and roads are blocked or something, how are you going to get that several hundred miles just to get your food and your water?
Well, see, again, that's part of being prepared is being aware. If you see the storm coming, we saw it coming. Don't get me wrong. Hurricanes are well predicted, and they see them far in advance. We had a week's warning with Andrew, but the mentality that really kind of to this day grates on me because I fell victim to it in Miami was the storm will turn. They hadn't been hit by a major storm in 25 years up until that point, and all the major hurricanes that had come that way had somehow, some way, been affected by the currents and the air. The water currents and the air currents, etc., and the storms had all turned north and had gone up along the coastline and never impacted with the city. And everybody was saying, "Nah, this one will turn. It'll go across the Bahamas. It'll hit the Gulf Stream and it'll turn north." Little did we realize that this thing was like a cannonball shot out of God's cannon. I mean, this thing hit the Bahamas. It slowed down very slightly from a Cat 5 to a Cat 4. Stream and it powered up to a Cat 6. In fact, they were talking about recategorizing or building a new category of hurricane for Andrew for many months afterwards. They never did. But when it impacted, the official category was 4 or 5. It depends on your source. And it went through Miami like a hot knife through cold butter. I mean, it was like that city didn't even stand. It didn't even slow the storm down. If you looked at satellite images after that storm, there was literally a ruler straight line drawn across the Florida Peninsula of brown where the center of the storm and the width of the storm had destroyed all the vegetation and killed it. And then when it hit the Gulf of Mexico, it powered up and it went north. Now, see, the unfortunate thing about this, Vinny, and I laugh about it because I left Miami 3 days after the storm. I went to Alabama, and little did I know, I had driven right back into the path of Andrew. And I'm heading north on Highway 65 in Alabama, and this storm, I mean, literally, it's like the worst thunderstorm I'd ever lived through, comes out of nowhere, starts dumping tons of water on my vehicle, and the wind is so hard, it's shaking the car around. I pulled off the highway. I'm sitting on the side of the road going, my gosh, I'm going to die. Where did this come from? And then I find out when I get to my destination that I actually had gone through Andrew a second time. It was horrifyingly bad luck.
I think this is why hurricanes are named after people the person who discovered them don't like.
Hurricane Jorge.
there's nothing good about storms and natural disasters and things of that nature. And I don't know exactly. I'm not a prepper, like, really, at all. I mean, we've got a portable gas burner with a number of gas bottles and things like that, and about 20 to 40 liters of water running around and a couple of sacks of rice and potatoes. But other than that, you know, we'd be pretty hard pressed to survive if something actually happened. And I think this actually goes back to the point that you were making before, is that people who are living paycheck to paycheck can't really prep to a large degree. It's simply not affordable. Although that's just an excuse, isn't it? Because if you save up like $2 a week, $3 a week or something, you can buy dried food that can be relatively cheap and last quite a long time.
Well, I always throw back at people, if you tell me that you can't afford to prepare, I can show you how to make a year's worth of food supply for less than $400 United States dollars. And if you really put that back, if you get paid every week and you can budget out $30 a week in 10 weeks time of saving money, or even, you know, let's say 15 weeks time of saving money, giving you some plenty of time, you can go out on week number 15, buy everything on the list, and put away 1 year's supply worth of food. Ready to it, but there's enough calories for 1 year for a family of four for $400. And that's in everything that you need to survive, all of the basic nutrition. And that will set you up right there with your food. Prepping is affordable. It's just a matter of mindset. I mean, I keep telling people, Vinny, if you go to McDonald's once a week or twice a week, you know, that's $20 to $30 you're spending just to eat one meal. But if you take dollars that you just spent on McDonald's and instead put it in the bank, after 10 weeks, you can buy a year's worth of food that'll feed four people. So it's not unaffordable. It's a mindset. You have to understand how to afford it. You have to understand how to approach it properly.
Yeah, that was what I was about to say, actually, is that when you're coming out of your comfort zone and you don't really know, if you're unsure or whatever, and most people will actually sit back and refuse to look at any further information and actually choose to remain ignorant instead of taking some responsibility and hence taking some action.
You know, that's absolutely right. We're coming up on the top of the hour, though, Vinny. I want to go ahead and go to my break. And before I sign off onto the break, I want to talk to everybody about Heavenly Scents by Sunny. Now, just so you guys know, I'm giving you a caveat. Sunny is my adopted mom. She's a mother of one of my very good friends from Miami, and she started her own company. And she is an older woman. She's retired, but she's looking at. And her husband live up in Dallas, but she started a candle company, and she is top notch when it comes to this. The candle company is called Heavenly Scents by Sunny, and you can find her at Heavenly Scents by Sunny, all one word, SU.com. They provide custom homemade glass and tin container candles, military candles, a portion of which each of those candle money is donated to the Wounded Warrior Project. I'm sorry. And they have seasonal candles, and they have scent tarts for you to burn in your potpourri burners. They have custom made candles that are made from American soy, produced from American grown soybeans. Now, soy wax is eco-friendly, renewable, sustainable, and carbon neutral. Soy wax burns slower than paraffin or beeswax, so the candle lasts a lot longer. For every ounce of wax that you burn, the candle will burn approximately 8 to 10 hours. It also provides a cleaner burn without any oily residue or smoke, as in paraffin waxes. Soy wax's ability to bond with more fragrance oil produces a more fragrant candle. They only use fragrances and oils that are uncut, 100% pure essential oils, ensuring not only the best cold throw fragrance from an unlit candle and the best hot throw fragrance when the candle is burned. All the fragrances they use in their custom-made candles are first tested by them to ensure both the cold and hot throws meet their high standards of quality. They currently ship via U.S. Postal Service to the continental U.S., and all shipments are insured. Please visit their Facebook page to view pictures of their candles, sample some of the pictures that they can apply to your candles. They do picture candles, their custom picture candles, and view their tested and approved fragrance list, which is updated regularly, as well as see some samples of their candles that they are selling. You can find them at Heavenly Scents by Sunny on Facebook. And we're going to head into our break here, and we'll come back after the top of the hour. And we're back from break, and I've got Vinny Eastwood on the line still, I believe, and we're going to go over some of the six apps that are available, free apps to help the beginning prepper get started. You there, Vinny?
Yeah. What's the haps with the apps?
Okay, well, see, for Christmas, I kind of gifted my children and myself with these really great Dragon Touch pads. They are Android-based pads. They're not Apple iPads. They're 7-inch screen reader pads, and we got them to take the place of their old handhelds because they're getting a little bit older. Well, I got one for myself, and I figured, you know, I bet you 98% of my listeners out there, they have iPhones or they have Android phones or they have iPads or something like that. And why not see if there were tools available for even the most basic prepper, the most out-of-the-gate beginning prepper to help them get kick-started? I mean, if you're comfortable using technology, this could well be the key to getting those really tech-savvy people to start prepping and start prepping wisely. And so I went looking, and I started off on MoboGenie, which is their app chooser, the chosen app program for this particular Dragon Touch. But I also looked on Amazon apps. If remember, you can find these here. So I thought I'd list out them, and we could get some information back and forth.
I'm not sure if it's you or me, but you seem to cut out every now and again. I'll lose a word or two.
Oh, that's probably because I turned my head away from the microphone and I have my audibility gain set really high. I'm going to turn it down. That should be much better now. So, like I said, my first pick on these apps for the beginning prepper, and this one is more or less to get people connected to preppers that are out there that are putting their information out there as well as some books. It's called Prepper's Survival Kit, and I don't know if it's all one word. You could do a search on your app download page, and it's a free app. All of these are free. They have ads, so be warned. Right here, Prepper's Survival Kit, it has links on it to Pathfinder, which is Dave Canterbury. You can link directly to his channel and see all of his newest videos, and they're listed. They have a link for Southern Prepper One, one of the guys who's pretty infamous. I mean, if you guys watch Doomsday Preppers, the prepping expert, Southern Prepper One was one of the prepping experts that National Geographic had actually contracted to evaluate the Doomsday Preppers preps. And I liked his stuff, and I've been watching his channel for years. There's also a link to Maine Prepper. He's a really solid guy. He's having some very unfortunate medical issues right now, so much love and much prayers going out to him. And also, if you haven't heard of her, and I shame on you if you have not, this links you to Patriot Nurses channel, and this lady she's phenomenal when it comes to medical stuff, when it comes to prepping. She offers classes. She's a highly opinionated lady. I got to give you that, but, you know, she has the right to be opinionated. It's her channel, and she's going to talk about what she wants to talk about. But the books that come with this is the big, for me, it's the big gain. You get the U.S. Army Survival Manual, you get Survival Medicine Handbook, and you get edible and medicinal plants built into this app, so they're always available. I think that's pretty cool.
I guess so.
Well, let's talk about, you don't know how to prep, okay, right? Vinny, you wouldn't, you got pretty basic ideas on how to prep, right?
Well, I mean, it's just basically comes down to making sure that you have food, water, medicines, and basically survival gear, more or less. It's not about having the amenities and the luxuries and portable battery-operated DVD players, is it?
Well, that's true. But see, if you have really basic ideas like yours, you would really benefit from what's called the Prepper's Bible Lite. It is a free app. Again, it's the Prepper's Bible Lite, and it comes with four different screens that you can go on, and only two that are going to be used by preppers. Now, the first screen at the very bottom is called prepping, and you click on that, and it gives you a list of subjects that you could read on. What is prepping? Why should I prep? How should I prep? When should I prep? That gives you a basic preparedness checklist, essential tools, things about alternative energy, communication, security, first aid, economics, things to be aware of, food and water, lighting, how to prep for pets, shelter, etc. So this is a really good light application for people just looking for information to get started. And this covers a broad range of subjects. So I think it's a pretty good app for free. I've been reading through it. I can't say that it's written for the advanced prepper. It's written for the beginning prepper, but heck, it's better than nothing.
Well, I suppose anything's better than nothing at the end of the day. And I think people are, including myself, really, you get lulled into a false sense of security. All right, and people like you who have actually experienced what it's like going without, the possibility is no longer a possibility. It's actually now real. It's kind of here, and it can kind of strike at any time, and that's not something that you can kind of shake off. I mean, and it's a traumatizing experience, and traumatizing experiences teach you a hell of a lot, and they usually teach you lessons that you do not forget. You know,
yeah, even if you want to forget them, it's like no, you'll wake up at night in a cold sweat remembering how horrifyingly bad it was.
Yeah,
it's not.
I'm 10 years old, 10 years on after getting arrested by police for selling weed, and I'm still reeling from it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I my first real bad experience with the police actually occurred when I was 15 years old, and it showed me how perception plays a big part of reality. Just some backstory. I was walking. I lived in a place called Cutler Ridge, which is outside of Miami. It's part of Miami Metroplex. And we had some friends, myself and my group of friends. We had a friend whose grandfather had a berry farm, a strawberry farm, huge strawberry farm. And one evening, as the sun was going down, it had to be summer or fall. But the sun was going down, and we had been out in the field shooting at, we were looking for rabbits to shoot at with our pellet guns, and we had a pellet gun on us. And it started to get very dark, and we were headed back towards the other end of the property, and we could see the main road just ahead of us. I mean, it was like 200 yards away, and there was this car coming along the main road, and then it turns in on the dirt road that we're on, and it's coming right at us with its brights on. And the next thing I know is there's some dome lights that go on, you know, the red and blue lights. They come on, and the car comes grinding to a stop, and the door on the passenger side flies open, and I hear the sound of a shotgun being racked. Check, check, drop it! And you're like, and I wet myself. I mean, it scared the crap out of me. All I was carrying was a pellet gun. I was 15, 16 years old, but this guy didn't know that I had a rifle or a pellet gun, and they came straight at me like a bat out of hell. The door flies open, and I'll tell you, the most intimidating sound, and I will tell you that to the day I die, the most intimidating sound is the sound of a shotgun being racked and then pointed at you. I mean, it's enough to loosen the bowels of the most brave grown man. So, yeah, I learned very quickly that the police aren't necessarily my friend at that point.
Especially when you confess everything to them, because they say that, hey, if you're honest with us, we'll go easy on you. And then they use your confession to manufacture evidence.
And I tell people now, and it's absolutely true, there's a guy on YouTube, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, but his patent standard answer is, I do not answer questions. I do not answer questions. They start asking him stuff, and he goes, I do not answer questions. Well, that's awesome, but my favorite one is, am I being detained? Am I being detained? If they answer yes, your answer is, I will not answer any questions. I want my lawyer. I will not answer any questions. I want my lawyer. Because let me tell you something, guys. There are law professors out there, United States law professors out there, that tell you, and they are being 100% honest, what you say can and will be used against you. That will. So don't say a thing. Shut your mouth. Repeat the same thing over and over again. Sound like a freaking broken record. I want a lawyer. I want a lawyer. I want a lawyer. I want a lawyer. That's all you have to say at that point.
Yeah.
You don't have to say a word else.
Well, the thing is, cops will always ask you the same question over and over because you haven't answered them the way they want you to answer, okay? So if they ask you, for example, the words, do you understand? It means, do you stand under my authority? Because they usually ask you, do you understand? After Absolutely. They say to you, I'm going to arrest you. And you say, no, I don't understand. I don't comprehend. I just don't get it, bro. I'm really confused here because you've got a Masonic checker on your hat and it's mesmerizing me. And I find always getting them to have a few laughs and stuff like that is actually really helpful. Because I am the smoothest talker when it comes to cops. I mean, I know what it's like. I know basically it's kind of like, take off the illusion that you're dealing with an authority figure who actually has their authority for a good reason and they use it for moral and ethical justified purposes. Imagine instead that you're talking to a gang member who's a criminal and they are trying to steal something from you. How do you react to that person? Normally you act really, really nice and do everything that they say until such a point as you can find an out, and then you get out of there before they can wind up stealing something from you. In this case, your freedom. And in some cases, permanently steal your state of mind that allows you to trust authority figures in the future.
And again, it's not a matter of mistrust. It's a matter of understanding that in the United States, at least, when you say, I do not answer questions, I would like a lawyer, and if that's all you say, they cannot do anything at that point to you. They can't use any statement you've made against you, because all you're saying is, I want a lawyer and I don't answer questions. That's all you need to say at that point in time. I mean, don't confess, don't be helpful, don't give out information, because guess what? You're putting information in their hands, like Vinny said, they will use it to get you in more trouble. I mean, you're not being helpful. You're not helping them prevent a crime, and you're not helping with the investigation. Let's face it, you're not a cop. You are now a what they call suspect. So shut your mouth, keep your mouth shut, and if you say anything, say, I would like a lawyer, and I don't answer questions.
Conveniently, in New Zealand, they just passed a law to mean that you don't have the right to remain silent anymore, and you have to confess your crimes.
All you have to say is, I don't answer questions.
They can actually arrest you and convict you of that now for not complying with a police officer in New Zealand. I don't answer questions. Okay, well, I'm ordering you to answer a question, and it's illegal to not follow my orders. So we'll put you in jail then. And you go, but that's illegal. You can't actually take away and deprive my rights like that. And they go, aha, but there's only 145 judges in New Zealand, and 122 of them are first cousins. So try getting an independent review once you get convicted.
Welcome to New Zealand, the epitome of the small town USA.
I mean, we put the incest into judicial incestuousness.
Oh my gosh. No joke. I'm not trying to crack too many jokes about the Kiwis. I love the Kiwis. But their country is so small, you could literally piss from one side to the other if you drink enough Fosters.
I mean, we don't drink Fosters, bro. That's Australians.
I know that.
Yeah. our Air Force, its symbol is a flightless bird. You know,
yeah,
it's just real smart move there, New Zealand. You know, you're onto it, boy, aren't you? Yeah. And guess how long it would last? They did like a military study to see how long our military would last against an invasion. About 7 minutes.
Your Air Force consists of an ultralight and two Cessnas. Awesome. Anyhow, I want to bring up the next app on my list. It's called the Survival Reader. Now, I really advocate this for anybody who's just getting out there and getting informed. This is actually an app that combines links to several blogs. As a matter of fact, some of the best blogs out there. I read several of them. The top one is SHTF Plan. That's a great blog to read for information, to break away from the standard media and get an idea of what's going on in your life or in your world around you. Another blog that they link to is My Family Survival Plan, which is more family-oriented prepping. Then they have the Survival Podcast on there. Links directly to the Survival Podcast. They have a link to Backdoor Survival. Really good, really good site. I've been there quite a bit. They have one for Survival Cache, one for their Survival Doctor, one for their Survival Mom, and my favorite, all of them, is Off-Grid Survival. That particular site is really like a clearinghouse of all kinds of fascinating information. So the Survival Reader, I advocate, it's a free app, and all it does is it loads an app on, then it gives you several different buttons. And again, I'm warning my listeners, look, it has a link on there for buy survival food and buy survival gear. Don't click those. Don't fall for the trap. Don't fall for the marketing bullshit. I'm sorry, but don't pay extra money for stuff that you can do on your own. You can find better survival gear, and you can purchase better survival food on your own that doesn't have a name brand on it and a 60 to 100% inflated price. So Survival Reader is a top one if you're learn more about prepping and survivalism. So Vinny, that's a good one for you to start reading on.
Yeah, man, absolutely. We can you send me the link to that?
I sure can. It's an app. So if you have a smartphone, you can go into your app store and just type in Survival Reader and it'll come up. It's a free app. I mean, it's free across all the platforms, Android, on Apple, and on Fire Android, because the Amazon App Store, it does all for the Amazon devices. So with this Android device, I also have a work phone that happens to be an iPhone. So I check all of them to make sure that they're available on both. So yes, it's just called the Survival Reader.
Hey, did you know that you can get a phone for preppers that you can stab people with? It's called a knife phone.
A knife phone. That's a good one. Is it real?
No.
Okay. I didn't think. I was like, man, that'd be pretty hardcore. It'd be illegal in every state.
I have an app to hack. You know, like away at your throat places.
I got a hacking app. That's funny. That's coffee on my screen. Okay, you got to stop that crap.
I'm sorry. I'll try and cut down the cackles.
Oh, jeez, man. Oh, bad pun. Bad pun. Oh, that stank.
Hey, look, man. Oh. If you can't joke about the collapse of society, what else are we going to laugh about?
Well, I laugh about the politicians. I mean, I'm listening to this stuff that, and it's as horrifying. I'm gonna talk about some serious stuff real quick. As horrifying as what happened in Paris over the past few days, they brought it on themselves. I'm just pointing this out to everybody out there listening. Paris thought it would be France thought it would be a really good idea to make personal firearm ownership against the law. So they figured that if they ban firearms, nobody's going to have them. And that includes the police officers. The police do not have firearms. The only people with firearms in the country of France are the military. And then you have these three loco, you know, men, these three crazy guys. If you want to call them terrorists, fine. If you want to call them radicals, fine. But they were Muslim. That was their religious bent. And they were yelling Abdul al-Akbar the whole time that they were doing this. And it was in retaliation for cartoons being drawn about their prophet. I mean, how bad is slander to your quote-unquote religious leader when you've got to go in and shoot people up because it pisses you off? But the point of fact remains that they killed all of these people, police officers included, because their society decided that the members of their society need to be unarmed, that it would be safer. And just the most ridiculous, asinine, bass-ackward, socialist bullshit I've ever heard. I mean, people died because they don't have the right to carry firearms to defend themselves. So there was not a soul that could protect them against these crazed gunmen that walked in there. And my heart and my prayers go out to the victims and the families. I mean, absolutely. But again, you look at this, Vinny. What do you think?
Well, I haven't yet investigated any kind of terrorism attack that got big media play where everything was exactly as the media played it out to be.
Well, I agree with that, but that's why I went to secondary media sources. I went to the man on the street kind of thing. And the tweets and the videos that were being released by people that witnessed what was going on absolutely support the fact that the gunmen were yelling out Allahu Akbar the whole time. It absolutely supported the fact that the newspaper was attacked because they wrote – satirical comedy, or they drew satirical comedy cartoons in which they depicted Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, in a very bad light. And frankly, Muhammad was a pedophile. He was a violent man, and his religion is based on the time that it was built, 600 years ago, you know, 600 or so years ago, and the mindset hasn't changed. It's still there. And I wanted to point out to people, guys, we might not be fighting the Crusades, but the Islamists, the fundamental Islamists, are still fighting the Crusades. They're still trying to conquer. They're conquering Europe right now. I mean, you have the Islamization of France, of Britain, of Germany, of Norway, of all of these countries where there's massive amounts of Islamic people moving in, and it's a quiet invasion. It's not with guns and bombs. It's literally they're overwhelming the populace.
And what my study of history says is that they're trying to actually sort of dilute down our cult. In fact, it's not the Muslims themselves, like, specifically going, hey, let's all move to France and Muslimize it. It's more the fact that they want to move there because it's literally a better life, and they're allowed by the socialist government to move in there in massive numbers because they want a massive culture of infighting to divide the people so that the government can keep going on with whatever it wants. And I saw an executive summary of Islam the other day, and I thought it was quite interesting because it's so many things are forbidden in it. Like, for example, it is forbidden in Islam to harm or mistreat in any way Christians or any people of the scripture.
Fail. They did not read the Quran, okay? In the earlier passages written at the beginning of Muhammad's prophetic career, that indeed was the case. However, the Quran, which I have read several times from cover to cover, and I do understand because I have a Middle Eastern background, I understand how it was written, is abrogated. It abrogates itself. Things that were written by Muhammad later in his prophetic career actually says what I wrote earlier, where we're not to harm the Christians or the people of the book, as they're called, is wrong. Now we are to wage war against them, which was written later after he had gained prominence and power in the areas around Saudi Arabia. His cult actually grew. So that actual statement is so wrong. It's because people don't understand Arab literature, and they really never read the Quran or how the Quran is structured. Muhammad himself changed the laws, changed the rules twice or three times on all kinds of things, like harming Christians or Jews. But it does state that if you subject them, that they are to be protected, but they are to be taxed heavily and treated as second-class citizens. And it outlines very specifically how that is to be done. The people of the book are to experience what's called the jizya tax, or an increased tax for not being Muslims. They are not allowed to build their own churches. They are to stand when a Muslim enters the room. Anyone who's a Christian or a Jew is to stand immediately. They are to give up their seats. They are not to make any loud noises like bells or prayers. They cannot make a noise louder than a clap when worshiping their God. And they can be subjugated to jailing and or death for any reason whatsoever because they are not primary class citizens of a Muslim country. I've read these things. I understand what Sharia law is. My family was massacred by Muslims. So,
it's funny. It's funny because it's also forbidden in Islam to oversimplify Sharia matters and ignore established Islamic sciences.
Well, and that's why you have 50 or 60 Sharia scholars who are constantly reading and interpreting the Quran and the secondary writings of the secondary prophets, the ones who followed Muhammad, and they're the ones who are actually – they're constantly evolving Sharia law in these countries, but the basic tenets of Sharia always stay the same. They do not waver, and you look at a country like Saudi Arabia, that is an absolute Sharia law country. You cannot enter the city of
Mecca.
Mecca, thank you. If you're a Jew or a Christian, you're not allowed in the city. You cannot enter that city. You have to live in separated enclaves inside the country of Saudi Arabia. And these are our quote-unquote allies, okay? But if you're caught with a Bible and teaching Christianity in Saudi Arabia, you can be beheaded. They can chop your head off under their law because you are violating the tenets of their Sharia law. You are teaching about a god or a religion other than Islam. And I'm sorry that I turned to this, but it came to mind that, you know, we have powerful people in the United States of America that are moving towards taking away our rights to own firearms. And we could end up like France. We could end up with the ability not to defend ourselves against enemies, whether they're foreign or domestic.
Mm. And I also find that very interesting, too, because Iran now has one of the largest growing Jewish and Christian sectors in the Muslim world. And they're kind of like pouring in there by comparison to the rest of the states because they're so open and tolerant of them for some reason.
Well, they're more tolerant than ISIS is right now. And where they're coming from is they're coming from Syria. And
by the way, this is Iran's America's enemy. They don't persecute Jews or Christians. And Saudi Arabia is the U.S. ally, and they do. Right.
What the Iranians are doing is they're welcoming in the Syrian people.
Yeah.
Syria is one of Iran's oldest allies. And they're opening the doors and they're saying, come on, we'll protect you. You're part of the country that's an ally to us. Meanwhile, ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call it, is running roughshod over the Christians and the Jews. They're marking their homes. They're taking them out and beheading them by the score. And
John McCain's taking pictures with them. And saying, yeah, we love ISIS.
It's an insanity. I mean, it's truly an insanity on the national front here. I mean, people are just looking at our politicians going, who the hell are you? And why did we elect you? And if they're not, they're truly part of the problem, Vinny. I mean, I see so many problems and so many more reasons why we should be prepared. And you're right. I don't forego any nation because of their religious belief or because of their ways that they want to do their laws, etc. I believe in human rights and I believe in making sure that everybody has an equal shake. You know, we all have our rights that come from the grand creators. We talked about the last time you were on. And when countries like Saudi Arabia are stoning people for being raped, they stone women who have been raped and it's not any fault of their own. They were raped, but they get stoned anyways because it is against Sharia law to be raped and then speak out against your rapist. There are men who get their heads cut off or they're hung because they're homosexual and it's patently against Sharia law. But yet we're allies. Our country is allies with this country. And yet you look at
it's a kingdom. Like, it's a freaking kingdom. It was like we threw off the monarchy because they were so evil. But these guys are all right. Yeah. Let's go and give them a big old kiss and huge military contracts as well. Hey, and while we're at it, bro, why don't we just say that Saddam Hussein's massing tanks against their borders in order to scare them into letting us set up a whole bunch of U.S. bases there so that we can invade Iraq? That'll be great. But what if they ask to see the photos? I will say we'll just can't show that to them because it's national security.
Yeah. And then you get the disconnect there where you have Iran and their only problem, their biggest problem is, number one, they don't like Israel. Okay, big deal. There's not a lot of countries in the Middle East that like Israel. Let me just put it on there. I'm going to put it in black and white. Israel is kind of like the redheaded stepchild of the Middle East. Not one country there really likes Israel. But Iran has made a very vocal point. We are going to destroy Israel. Fine. Let's watch them and make sure they don't do that. As long as we want to keep an ally.
When did they say that exactly?
Oh, they've been saying that since 1978, since the Ayatollah Khomeini took over and they ousted the Shah of Iran. They've been making these statements.
So they ousted the U.S. Appointed dictator, the Shah, who killed heaps of people and destroyed lots of their freedoms. And then they got somebody else who said, in fact, I think it was the recent Iranian leader who said words to the effect of the ideology of Zionism and its political will be wiped off the map, and that was later deliberately misinterpreted by Western media to say we're going to wipe Israel off the map, but it's blatantly not true. It's a complete lie, and it's been repeated a thousand times over and over.
And again, even if it's true, we can watch them. But we see, if you want to look on a basis of human rights, Iran, their only violation out there is, number one, they said, according to the Western media and the Western power structure, that excuse me, I just hiccuped, that they want to wipe out Israel. Okay, great. Number two, they want to develop nuclear power for civilian use. I'm okay with that as long as they're okay with, you know, people watchdogging the entire program. I'm not comfortable with Kim Jong-un having nuclear weapons capability, but he does. So we watch them very closely. Now, he's a tin pot dictator, true, but you know, you've got this Iranian president who is just a titular figurehead. You really have to look to the Iranian clerical leadership, the Ayatollahs that actually they lead the country from the religious standpoint. They are a country of Sharia law, but not strict Sharia law. And again, if you want to look from left to right at basic human rights violations, we, America, should be going into Saudi Arabia and kicking the snot out of those dumb towel heads and taking all of their oil fields for our own use and leave Iran the hell alone, because in the grand scheme of things, Saudi kills more people because they have a sexual deviation according to the Quran.
Well, not to mention most of the hijackers, alleged 9/11 hijackers, were Saudis anyway.
People didn't even realize until I brought it up on my blog years ago that Osama bin Laden is a Saudi. It's one of the more moderate and less violent sects of Islam. But yet he's sitting there, and he was trained, and this is well documented and proven. He was trained to be a terror insurgent by the United States as part of a war against Russia in Afghanistan. And we formed Al-Qaeda back in the 60s, in the 70s, when they were being when the idea was being built and then finally brought to fruition, so that they could fight against the Soviet Russians' incursions into Afghanistan. And basically, we created our own bogeyman.
Yeah, it seems to me that, like, if you look at Iran, how many countries have they invaded in the last 300 years? Zero. How many countries has America invaded in the last 100? You know,
wrong. Iran did actually invade somebody. They invaded Iraq. Iran and Iraq.
That was because Iraq attacked them first, and with U.S. weapons that were sold to them by Donald Rumsfeld.
Let's be fair. They did actually participate in one cross-border conflict, one. But United States, like you pointed out, we've invaded 300-plus countries. We've gone to non-justified war in at least two Asian countries, one of which is not even over. We don't have a peace treaty with North Korea. We have a ceasefire. And a lot of people don't realize that ceasefire is just a bunch of names on a piece of paper, and it can end tomorrow. So, well, yeah, we've done a lot worse in the past 300 years, or not even 300 years. Shoot, we've only been a country for, what, 230 or 240 now?
Maybe people have to get wise to the reality that America is actually a satanic state. Now it is. It's ruled by satanic elites. They have no Christian values whatsoever, and they just want to kill, destroy, create chaos, and then propose solutions after the fact that the chaos that they created, so that they can benefit themselves yet again and gain even more power and control over the populace.
I was kind of losing you there. You want to say that again?
I was just saying that America's now run by Satanists. They're not Christians. They're basically desiring power and control and death and murder and scumbaggery, and they won't stop until they have everything under their power.
I agree. We're living in the twilight zone, my friend.
It's one of the most important points to realize, don't you think, that if you're an American and you identify yourself as Christian, just remember that the first enemy is your own government, because they're your actual real enemies first and foremost, is Satanist scumbags who want to kill you, and they're far more likely, statistically at least, to kill you than any Muslim is. I mean, more people die from peanut allergies from alleged Muslim terrorism, and half the alleged Muslim terrorism is basically US-funded or state-sponsored Muslim terrorism, and usually by the people that are actually being attacked by said Muslim terrorists.
Well, I do have to say, on the side of people who are cautious against Muslim terrorism, I mean, yes, Islam is a 1 billion plus person religious ideology or political ideology out there in the world. And according to even the most moderate Muslim out there, that only about 25% of Islam is radicalized to the point where they're attacking other countries under an agenda of forwarding a Islamic state. Now, I want to put those numbers into some very direct reality here. That's 35 million radicals. That is the equivalent of the population of the United States of America.
350 million.
No, I'm sorry. You're right. 300. I've dropped a zero. 350 million worldwide. The equivalent to the population of the United States of America is looking to forward their political and religious ideology through the use of violence. So it's not a small threat, but is it a direct threat? I don't think so. Not so much in the United States, at least not right now. In countries like in France, yes. I mean, it can be. And it's rearing its ugly head right now. In countries like Spain, it has been. In countries like, oh, I don't know, Malaysia, where there's a direct conflict between the Christian and the Islamic believers, yes. I mean, you have the Tamil Tigers against the Christians there. And it's just a massive amount of raping and killing, and just for the sake of being politically dominant or religiously dominant, it's out there. It's but is it a direct threat to me right now? No. Am I going to ignore it? No. I'm going to be aware of it, but I'm not going to fall into that bull crap trap that my government wants to feed me. With one hand, they're saying these Islamic terrorists are the worst enemy we have. With the other hand,
and we know because we created them.
Right. But there you got John McCain going out and getting photographs taken. I mean, let's here's a reality check, people. Here's a big reality check. George Bush sat down and said that the Taliban, this was George Bush Sr., said that the Taliban was the equivalent to our founding fathers, our revolutionary founding fathers. They're fighting for freedom and that they're fighting for what's right. And yet less than 15 years later, the Taliban is the enemy and we're bombing the crap out of them. I mean, this is duplicity. This is exactly political bull crap and pandering and as Vinny puts it, scumbaggery. Yeah. I mean, this is the ultimate betrayal.
And they can't even watch American Idol in Afghanistan anymore because of the Taliban.
Oh, I know. Vinny, to me, it's like the most asinine thing to have a government on one hand that's telling you this is bad for you, and then on the other they're saying, but these people are okay. And it's all double talk and it's all bull crap, and the average person is falling for it.
Well, and we get emotionally swept up in it as well. Like I notice, like sometimes when people disagree with me about something that I think that I understand, and they're telling me information that I don't know already, I get emotional about it. Like I kind of get angry, get sarcastic with them, and that kind of thing. And I've started to notice that, like, that's the thing that your brain does when it knows that it's wrong, but doesn't want to admit it to itself, kind of thing. And it's been happening to me a lot lately. Like I've been talking to a lot of people who are a bit smarter than I am, a lot better researcher, generally a bit older than me. They've had decades on me in order to research these things that they know. And I'm noticing this this propensity that I have, and also noticing it in other people, that we don't want to know anything different to what we think we already know to a large degree.
And that's where I feel like there's a big disconnect. There's a mental disconnect, because the minute you stop listening, the minute you stop learning, the minute you stop investigating is the minute you start dying inside, because you become so hard set in your ways. Wrong or right, you're so hard set in your ways that you can't even have an open enough mind that if somebody has any information or proof or any contradictory statements to make, even in the spirit of just saying, hey, what if, you know, playing the devil's advocate, you literally alienate people. You might not intend to, but you do. And I'm not hateful. I don't dislike Muslims or people that worship Islam. I don't dislike Buddhists. I don't dislike anybody. Again, for me, it's not the color of your skin or the part of your culture that I'm interested in. It's the content of your character. I judge you by the content of your character. I know very, very strongly that there's lots and lots of Christian mass murderers out there. But we don't make it into a big Christian conspiracy to kill Americans. But the most of the mass murders in the United States have been Christian, unfortunately. So again, it is not the color of your skin or the creed that you follow. It is the content of your character.
Have you noticed that that's actually the difference between communism and Christianity or whatever, but they have the same defense mechanism? So Christian will go out and murder a whole bunch of people and they say, ah, he wasn't a real Christian. Communist will go out and murder a couple of million people and they go, ah, he wasn't practicing real socialism. So basically, anything that you believe is supposed to work out and doesn't work out the way you thought it should, it just wasn't done correctly, as opposed to you're actually wrong and it doesn't freaking work and you should maybe come up with a new idea. Perhaps question your current foundation of beliefs. I mean, I'm only 30 years old and I figured this out. What's everybody else's problem?
Right. I mean, and again, I think it's a defense mechanism for a human being. I think it's beholden back to our herd mentality, Vinny, in all honesty. It's a knee-jerk reaction. If you're shoved out of your comfort zone, if somebody throws something at you that you just can't process mentally, you experience cognitive dissonance and you start denying, even if it's the evidence is in front of you, you start vehemently denying it. You start making excuses why it can't be true. And that kind of cognitive dissonance leads to conflict. It leads to death. It's just a bad thing. And I mean, I suffer from it too. I've caught myself, you know, out of hand, just dismissing someone because I just don't agree with them politically or for whatever reason. And I start looking for reasons to discredit them or trying to discover why they're wrong and I'm right. And I have to sit back and stop myself and go, wait a second. Why am I thinking like this? You know, what's motivating this?
There's the ultimate question that you can ask yourself all the time. Am I acting like a douchebag? It's just like every now and again the answer is yes. And they're like, oh bro, I'm sorry. It was my bad. I was acting like an idiot. You know, this reminds me of a quote actually from Lawrence of Arabia, funnily enough. Young men make wars, and the virtues of war are the virtues of young men, courage and hope for the future. Then old men make the peace, and the vices of peace are the vices of old men, mistrust and caution. It must be so.
Yeah, that's very profound philosophical statement right there, and I can't find any flaw with it at all. I mean, I diverge so far off of the subject of prepping with you because, I mean, I always try to encourage my listeners, and on many shows in the past, I've always told them being aware is part of being prepared. And an awareness of not just the world around you, not just what's happening locally, statewide, nationally, internationally, but also what's happening inside you. You can actually defend against bad things happening from your own creation. You know, defending against bad attitude, having a judgmental attitude, being, as you called it, a douche. I mean, that's the Bible. This is the Bible in one sentence. Don't be a douchebag.
It's pretty much straightforward like that. I mean, if you're going to give people who are illiterate and widely spread apart and have vastly different cultures and come from different parts of the world the same rules to follow, you better basically just give them the simplest rule possible. Don't be a douchebag. Isn't that pretty straightforward? I mean, DBAD, the D-bad.
Yeah, don't be a douche. Now,
as opposed to being a D-bag.
Right. Well, I mean, and we are simplifying things down to like the most distilled it down to the most vile thing we could name.
See, if we were in Islam, it would be illegal to oversimplify this like this.
You know, thank God I'm not a Muslim because I'd have to blow myself up.
Hey, I saw a great cartoon the other day. It's at Muslim training camp. There's a dude with an explosive vest on, and he's got like a class in front of him, and he goes, and he's got the detonator in his hand. He goes, "All right, watch closely. I'm only going to do this once."
Oh, that's awesome! That is awesome. Oh, I like to pick fun at a lot of different mindsets, and the Christian mindset is not immune from it. I mean, I identify as a Christian in faith and in an upbringing. I'm not a Catholic. I'm not a Lutheran or whatever. I'm a Christian, if you want to get down to the brass tacks. But it doesn't mean that I have any kind of how shall I say this? I don't have all the answers, and by and far, I am not a perfect man. And so I can't sit there and say, "Oh, you're a Buddhist. You've got it all wrong, man. This is where you got to go right." I'm not going to say that to somebody. I mean, I'm going to give them the ability to make mistakes. I'm going to tell them what I think and what I feel, but I'm not going to force it down somebody else's throat. I don't talk about it very much on my show, but I do have to say that we all have foundational beliefs, whether we want to acknowledge them or not. If we're agnostic, if we're atheist, there is still a foundational belief in there. If you're an agnostic, you believe something out there bigger than you. You just don't know what it is, and you'd like to see some proof. If you're an atheist, you have faith that there is no such thing as a big thing out there, as an intelligent design, a creator, whatever. And that in and of itself is a religion, having a faith against a God.
They actually opened a church of atheism in London last year.
Right. Oh, I know. And it's so funny. It's so funny. I hear people saying, well, I'm a-religious. I'm an atheist. I'm like,
So, what are you going to do? You're going to go there on Sundays and worship nothing.
they go there on Sundays and just hang out. They don't do a thing.
See, I don't do organized religion. Okay, it doesn't mean I'm not spiritual. I just don't, follow big lists of rules that are put in a book like a couple of hundred years ago. I think that the world changes on occasion, and that basically you can't really keep up with it if the source material is over 1,000 years. I mean, that's just me. I could be wrong.
I mean, I'm gonna say this in the most basic sense that I can say this. A religion is a man-made thing. Okay, organized religion is absolutely positively a man-made thing. But faith is a personal thing. Having a faith, having a belief system, it's very personal. And your relationship with that which you believe in is very personal. And there is no outside force, no outside creation that can encapsulate your true beliefs, how you feel in your heart. So I'm against organized religion myself simply because I am not let me say this. I'm not without having my illusions crashed. I mean, I was born into and raised in a very Catholic family, and I learned before I was 15 the kind of fallacies that I was raised in, and I stepped away as quickly as I could from that, and I'm not an advocate for organized religion at all.
That's one thing that I find is very, very interesting, is that there are benefits to being part of organized religion. I mean, if you look at the statistics, and the one that I actually – in fact, this is the reason why I chose – I made a intellectual decision to choose to believe in God or a higher power because of this one example I found out. It's about Vietnamese POW camps. And the American soldiers that were stuck in those POW camps that were atheists, overwhelmingly, statistically, they died in those camps. And the ones who were really, really strong believers in God had a much, much higher survival rate. And the reason for this is because when you're alone in that cell without hope of rescue and you don't believe in a higher power, you're really alone in that cell and you're really with no hope of rescue. However, if you have that belief structure, just believing that you've got something to look forward to, either that be an afterlife or hope for the future, something to pray to or whatever, that can actually allow your mind and your heart to build a resilience to the reality that is around you and actually defy it in and of itself.
Well, that touches on one of the rule of threes. I mean, we have in survival training, you get the rule of threes, and they come from it's called survival and evasion resistance training, or SEER. And the rule of threes is very simple. It's 3 seconds without air, or 3 minutes without air. I'm sorry, not seconds. It's 3 minutes without air. It's 3 days or 3 hours without shelter, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food and 3 months without hope. And that last one is almost as critical as the rest: water, air, food, shelter. Because hope, if you lose hope, if you don't have hope, you give up. You just totally give up the ghost. And there's countless, I mean, countless thousands of documented instances where people who lacked any kind of hope died because they simply gave up the will to fight. And those who had hope or had hope in something gave themselves something to hang on to and had a fighting spirit. And they actually could fight through even the most adverse conditions. As you pointed out, POWs holding on to their faith and being confined in a solitary confinement situation. Without that hope, they would have lost their mind, lost their sanity, or lost their lives. They would have just given up.
And that's the thing, you can draw on strength with things that are beyond you. And I think that is one of the biggest things to take away from any kind of spiritual belief structure, is that it doesn't matter what you believe, just right. Believe it, and you will draw real power from it.
Right. Well, Vinny, I got to tell you, we're closing out at the top of the hour. I got to put on my closeout music. But I really want to say thank you again for visiting with us and being on the show a second time. It kind of offset me from what I was going to talk about, but I can always talk about those other things. It's always nice to have a great guest like you on. And I love how we cover a lot of ground. You're one of my favorite people to talk to. You always have been. So I want to again say thank you on my behalf and on behalf of my listeners. I want to remind my listeners that Yeah, go ahead. Go. Plug your site.
TheVinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question in Eastwood, as in go ahead, make my news. And I'm raising money to buy some equipment for a documentary that I'm going to make, hopefully released on the 4th of July, explaining the problems in New Zealand and America and how they're virtually identical.
Oh, that's awesome. I can't wait to read some more about that. And I want to see your documentary. That would be great. And I wanted to remind listeners that I am on The Week in Review. I'll be on in 2 hours on Kevin's show. It follows mine immediately on these three stations: Liberty Movement Radio, RAS Radio, and Revere Radio Network. I want to thank you again, Vinny, for being on. And I want to thank the listeners for tuning in. And I want to thank Rob Revere, Sean Raspatello, and Cecile for all of their help and support in keeping this show. I always close with my question: got preps, pray for the best, and prepare for the worst. I'll see you on Week in Review in a couple hours.